This is part one of a two-part episode.
We're going to talk to an alleged expert on Eldritch Moon today. We start with something you might know about Sam. Sam Stoddard.
That's true. I know a lot about me.
Are there any other experts on Sam Stoddard we should consult? All right. I'm getting over my nervousness. Do we need to do anything last minute, guys? Anything we want to talk about?
No. I want to say no.
And say it.
No, we did not.
All right. I'm Phil DeLuca.
I'm Nate Burgess.
And I'm Sean Watson.
And we are Commander In. And now there's music playing. Thanks for listening, everybody. Oh, it's not going to get any better than that. We're going to put a spotlight on community issues, of course, but never, ever will we talk about three banned topics: religion, politics, and Hearthstone. Remember to head over to join our Patreon community at patreon.com/commanderandmtg. And by donating as little as a buck a show, you can participate in events like our Eternal Masters giveaway, which we'll talk about a little bit later, and help us format the show and come up with topics and all sorts of fun things. Like this week, we have a wonderful show lined up for you. We're going to talk about Eldritch Moon, specifically developing it. And to do that, we brought on an alleged expert on Eldritch Moon development. None other than, the lead developer of Magic Origins and Eldritch Moon, the rocket-fueled intern-cum-senior game designer, Sam Stoddard! Say hi, Sam.
Oh, hey. Glad to be here. I don't know what exactly I was waiting for, but glad to be here.
You were overcome momentarily.
Glad to talk about my favorite topic, which is, of course, me.
Yeah.
Things that I work on.
And you work on some pretty cool things.
I think so.
Yeah. We're going to get all into the latest really cool thing that was released, at least. I know you're working on other things. But not everybody knows who you are. So could you tell us a little bit about yourself, like what you were up to before Wizards? And
yeah, so I'm originally from Columbus, Ohio.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's a great city. Before Wizards, I went to college, played a lot of Magic, played on the Pro Tour a couple times, started doing some article writing for Star City, did some commentary, and eventually new people at Wizards got the opportunity to come in as an intern. It's a little bit of a misnomer, but as that position, got hired on, and the rest is history, I guess.
Yeah, that's cool. Now, what did you do professionally before Wizards?
I worked for the state of Ohio, basically the Board of Regents, which was their governing body for higher education. And my job was to work on credit transfer and making it easier for people to transfer from two-year colleges to four-year colleges and making sure they could, kind of get all their credits to transfer over.
Did you have any influence on the actual system that was used?
Very little. Mostly I was there to kind of streamline some stuff and kind of create the rules for some of the pathways and just make sure people were actually getting to a point where they were complying with what the legislation said. But I didn't have a ton of influence on saying, okay, this should equate to that.
So you've been working to streamline systems, as it were, professionally for your entire career.
It's true. It's true. Well, most of my career... as a 16-year-old, I was building computers, which was not streamlined, especially where I was doing it. If you've ever hot glued anything into a motherboard, it's not pretty.
Oh, you hot glued stuff into a motherboard? I think that's counterindicated, isn't it?
Yeah, it was not the greatest shop. It was a this person owned it who really didn't know a ton about computers and had a habit of selling things that didn't exist. And she sold something where we couldn't actually put them in the motherboards because there was no it was a way back in the late 90s with the Celeron chip and this motherboard, and we couldn't actually get in there because there wasn't an adapter. And her solution was to hot glue the processors into the motherboard. And you shouldn't do things like that. That's not good.
Now, did they work?
They worked. Well, they worked long enough for us to ship them. I have no idea. It was a summer job, so for all I know, they broke a month and a half later. I'm not even sure anyone turned them on, because we sold things to school systems, so.
So, don't ask me how I know this, but a tip. Never ever use a hot glue gun in the nude.
I can imagine.
That was an interesting evening. But yeah.
The Warhammer days.
It was, yeah, it was. I was actually building a large replica of Isengard from Lord of the Rings, and it was very early in the morning, and a certain fleshy part of my anatomy got stuck to my thigh.
Sam, I think we were talking about how we learn new things every episode.
Certainly a new thing for me to learn.
Yeah.
Hot tip.
Oh, boy. So to speak.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll get into your career at Wizards a little bit later when we talk about our main topic. But first, some news. And there hasn't been a great deal of news in the Magic community this week. So we're going to talk about our deck review group on Facebook. Patron Mason Talley is the moderator for a deck review group, and that allows our listeners to just join the Facebook group, submit a deck for review, and then provide feedback on other people's decks. The idea came about because we were looking at each other's decks in the deck testing group we maintain on Facebook, and we went ahead and did it. We've tested the process out, and it works pretty well, so now we're actually reviewing decks. So come on by and join the deck review group. We'll provide a link in the show notes. As always, you can also join our Patreon community at patreon.com/commanderinmtg. And again, like we said in the intro, for a buck a show, you can join. Right now, we're actually hosting an Eternal Masters giveaway contest for our patrons and a couple of lucky listeners. So head on over there. You'll get all the details by joining the Patreon community. And again, the sooner you join that, the better your chances are in the Eternal Masters contest. So let's talk about, especially you, Sam, let's talk about what we've been playing or playtesting. And we'll start it off so that you feel comfortable later on. Nate, what have you been playtesting?
I got inspired by Sean Tabaris at a recent Commander's Brew episode where they were doing X spells, and I've always liked the card Villainous Wealth, and I decided to brew a deck that was designed to play it, and it will annoy both Sean and Phil.
I've played against it. I can testify he's not wrong.
Oh, great. Great.
Because a deck that's good at playing Villainous Wealth is also probably pretty good at casting Mind Grind and Exsanguinate.
Yeah, it turns out.
Yeah.
My Damia of the Big Waves deck is actually built to kind of maximize mana production as well. And it has Villainous Wealth and all of the wonderful X spells that do similar things. So, looking forward to that, Nate.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Were you the guy who mined? Who was it who mind grinded somebody for like 40? Oh no, that was somebody with a in paper on the playtesting group. Well, Sean, I was inspired by a deck you built recently, and of course we're talking about the Geesa and Giralf deck. How do you pronounce that? Is it Geesa and Giralf or Geesa and Giralf?
I would go for the latter.
I believe it's Geesa and Giralf.
So it's the soft and hard G, and respectively. So the Geesa and Giralf deck that Sean built was pretty cool. It's zombie-themed, and I, while I was preparing for an interview this week, I did some just strawberry fielding, just some solo play, and that was a lot of fun. You built a nice deck, and if it can get rolling, my goodness, it takes off.
Yeah, like all decks I build a version of it and then keep tuning and tuning and tuning, so the version you've been playing with is very much version 1. So there's a few bits I'm not happy with. Also, some new cards in Eldritch Moon that when I brewed it, I hadn't seen.
Right.
That I've just read and went, oh my god, that's going in. So the guy that gives everyone menace?
Yeah.
All the zombies menace?
The enchantment.
Hell yes. I'm having a slice of that in a deck. And I quite like the new White of Precinct 6, the Liliana's Elite, is it? Yeah, that should probably go in. The aim of the deck was to try and use the sort of Dimiri side of it to mass cast out of the graveyard once it was there, or keep recurring spells like, I don't know, Evacuation, Cyclonic Rift, that sort of thing, to keep the board nice and level until you can take it over with little zombie dudes.
Have you seen Contingency Plan?
No. Should I?
It's probably in your theme.
Oh, cool. As I say, I don't know if I'll ever paper it out. I feel that G&G, as I'm going to call them, are the zombie general I've always wanted. Because I thought Grim was too Voltron-y for me. I don't really like Voltron decks. So these two... Yes, Nate. I know you like Voltron decks.
And especially Grimgrin.
Mm-hmm. Commander damage, good.
I'm not saying he's a bad commander. I'm saying that he doesn't play into a style of commander that I particularly enjoy. So these two are going to be the thing. Now, I really should have put the individual G&G in there, but I was running out of space for cool zombies once I'd already put like Archaeomancer and Mnemonic Wall and stuff in.
Yeah.
So I left them out, but I don't know.
Yeah, that was the one thing I was toying with, was whether or not to cut back on the sorcery and instant recursion and add G&G, the individuals.
But what point does it just become a standard zombie tribal deck at that point? I guess the Dimir in me wants that instant and sorcery recursion because that's my bread and butter and how I like to play Magic. So I think it's... someone on our Patreon group said recently, Sean's not happy unless he's beating you with your own spells. And they're right. So, yay.
Yeah, and in the meantime, you've been playtesting Sidri, right?
I spoke about it in the last episode a bit, but I've just been tuning it. I made it a little bit faster. I had a good game against Nate's Villainous Wealth deck where I gave him a special shiny hat to wear, didn't I, Nate?
Yeah, he snuck up behind me and put one of the beta versions of the Oculus Rift on my head. Then gave me a bunch of bad advice. It made him really happy because he was beating me with my own spells.
Occam Daxum into a Mindslaver was good fun. And then cast Nate's Blatant Thievery to take Charles's Ashnod's Altar to sacrifice all Nate's stuff down a big Ashnod-shaped hole. And Nate, you really shouldn't have cast Exsanguinate for zero.
Yeah, that's happened a few times with this deck.
Yeah, you should really put some mana into that. But yes, Sidri, I'm loving, I'm absolutely adoring that commander. It's wonderful deck to play. I'm sad I didn't do it sooner, but happy I've got it now.
So Sam, this is a kind of a weighty question for you, depending on how you take it, but what have you been playtesting recently?
Well, certainly there are a lot of things I can't talk about. A lot of future sets. It's interesting to see just how many years worth of sets I can end up playing in 1 week. Whether it's, I'm trying to think of, within my time at Wizards, the most ever was probably like 3.5 years worth of different sets when it's like FFLing with stuff that's coming out very soon versus being on like an exploratory design team for a set that starting on one of those where it's like, okay, it used to be after a year of exploratory design, it would go into a year of design and then basically a year of development, and then it would have to wait about 6 months after development ended to come out. So all of a sudden it's like my first starting there in 2014, and very soon after that playing what's the starts of Battle for Zendikar at that period of time. So that's the kind of length of time that goes through things. It's pretty crazy.
Is there actual playtesting during exploratory design?
Yeah, a lot of what exploratory design is, initially it was more like, let's try to figure out what all the stuff the set's going to do is, and I think that was just less successful, and now it's more of a shotgun approach of like, hey, here's the idea of the set, and here are some of the themes. You know, sometimes it's a world we're going back to. Sometimes it's a world that's brand new and we have very little information on it, or we have a top line thing. So, you know, for something like Theros, the top line was it's Greek world, and we have to figure out, okay, what does that mean? And so the thing that that exploratory design really does now is, okay, let's just try a bunch of mechanics out. And so, you know, we talk about stuff, come up with ideas, and say, okay, well, this might be fun. Usually it's the stuff that's I don't know, the kind of, you know, the Saturday Night Live thing, not quite ready for primetime players, where it's stuff that's more out there, because certainly when something gets to development, we can make stuff work. And, you know, we can say, okay, well, you know, in Eldritch Moon, for instance, the escalate is a mechanic that was made in development. It's like, okay, well, we can make this work. It's pretty simple. We know how this is going to play out. Don't have to spend a lot of time thinking about it, where things like meld are ones that, you know, have to be thought of a long time in advance, because near the end of the process, I mean, if you came to people and said, we want to do this thing where we combine these two cards, that would not go over very well. But early on, you got to do really crazy things, make up very simple decks and just play them more as a proof of concept. And the exploratory team kind of hands the design team over, okay, here are 20 mechanics we play tested, and here are the ones we like the most. And then it's up to the design team to really figure out, okay, here's how we want to kind of pick and choose from here what's working, and figure out what the space that got explored by the exploratory design team, which are the ones that are fruitful, which are the ones that are not fruitful. Just as an example, for Shadows, the exploratory design team really had focused on opponent milling as being the thing, because you're supposed to be driving your opponent insane. And we ended up obviously cutting that and going back to milling yourself, because we found that was more fun. But because the exploratory design team had really spent a lot of time trying that out, we at least had a starting basis to go, okay, here's the best possible things you can do with this, and okay, here's why we don't want to do it, as opposed to us spending on the design team, you know, 4 months exploring opponent mill and then finding out at the end of that we want to change.
Yeah. And is the design process flexible enough to accommodate that if you know, that 4 month exploration occurs and then it's like, oh no, we want to change? Or Is it by then you've invested so much time in that phase of the project that to change it really causes the project to suffer?
Well, I won't say that we are immune to the sunk cost fallacy, but certainly we are aware of it. And for something like Shadows, where the, you know, exploratory design team spent a lot of time doing opponent mill, and then the design team, we started off doing opponent mill, and you know, maybe a month or so into the thing changed. Like, we know that at that point we're throwing a lot of stuff away, but we have a lot of time, partially so you can throw stuff away.
Yeah.
We're not, well, the thing that we don't have that a lot of other game companies have the luxury of is saying, we'll release when it's done, because we're done when it's done. Like, we have these releases that are scheduled years in advance, so it's kind of hard for us to say, well, can we have another 6 months on this? Like, that's just not how our timelines are set up. But certainly the design process understands it's going to throw a lot of stuff out. What design is handing over to the development side is not the final version. In Eldritch Moon, as an example, the only mechanic that remained from design that went in development was meld. Both mechanics that are in the set now got added in development. So, you know, there was just a ton of stuff that got taken out of the set as a result of that. And we kind of build that into our timelines and understand that that's going to happen. And we prefer that not happen, but with the, you know, with the way that things go and, you know, playtesting and different eyes getting on people, it's just an inevitable thing that will end up occurring. And if you try too hard to save everything, then yeah, things are just not going to turn out well, and you're going to end up with a product that nobody's really happy with in the end.
Right.
Do you store, abandoned designs? Do you store them in, like, a vault that you can dip into and say, hey, we've designed something like that similar in future sets?
Regrettably, the vault is mostly in Mark Rosewater's head, which is not the most useful place for it. We do have a wiki that has a lot of all the information. I will say that we are not the greatest about having like the, you know, the one page that has, okay, here are all the things we tried that didn't work out. A lot of it is just, you know, tribal knowledge and stuff that, you know, we're playing something, you know, well, you know, we did try something like that a couple of years ago. Why didn't we do that? And ideally someone remembers either, sometimes it's like, well, why didn't we do that? And it was like, oh, because it was horrible and it was unfun and everyone hated it. Or sometimes it's, why didn't we do that? Well, the set that had come out the like 6 months earlier had done something too similar, so we couldn't do it. Or, you know, sometimes there are things we didn't do because of a rule thing, and then the rules have changed since then. As an example, having DFCs...
That's double-faced cards.
Having DFCs as legendary characters was something we didn't do in the original Innistrad, because DFCs as legends is really bad under the old legend rule, due to the fact that if you have your DFC werewolf on one side with a name, a legend, and I've got it on the other side, like, it's just this weird kind of game of chicken, and things blow up, and it, you know, so we were like, yeah, we don't want to do legendary permanence that way. Then obviously we change the legendary rule. All of a sudden we open ourselves up for that, for legendary lands were something we had not done for years because of how kind of horrible the whole legend rule made legendary lands. And the,
right,
you know, the fact that you could wasteland somebody before they could react to it was just super bizarre and weird. So we changed that. And all of a sudden in the last few years, we have printed a couple legendary lands because it's a useful thing to work on and to balancing point. And now that the rules aren't horrible with it, we can actually do it.
Very cool.
On his podcast, Mark has said numerous times that he wishes that the legendary rule wasn't exclusive because it deters playing multiple copies of a card. How do you feel about that?
I know Mark feels that way. I think I really like the legendary rule. I like parts of it. The problem is there are definitely legend cards we make as legends, you know, either for commander or because they're a story character, and it's like, yeah, I wish we could play four of these, that'd be cool. And there are other ones where the thing we get to do with the legendary rule is sometimes, you know, there's a card where it's like, it's not a legend, and this happened with Nykthos, it's not a legend, and it's like, yeah, you know, it's just too strong, like, you know, how are we going to balance this? And one way to balance a card like Nykthos is to say, well, make it into a legend. That way, people can only have one in play. They're less likely to play four on their deck. Didn't have to happen with that one. People just did play four anyway. A card like Thalia, the original Thalia, perfectly fine legend, totally fine. You turn that into a not, if you take away legendary and make it into just like an all upside tag, then all of a sudden we can't make a card exactly like that. We'd have to, you know, maybe add some text to it that says, you know, you can only have one of these in play at a time, just because rules get weird. Or also any card, Alhamrat's Archive is an example of a card that became legendary because it turns out that having two of those in play, when you double things, doubling it's big. So, you know, we started playtesting with it, and I think that originally it was four mana and non-legendary, and it was like, okay, play this on turn four, turn five, play another one, cast Magmatic Insight, discard a land, draw four cards, and it was like, oh boy. All right, well, legendary it is then. So I, you know, as someone who's more concerned about balancing things frequently, I do find it to be super relevant and something that comes up enough that I'm pretty happy leaving it as it is. But certainly, you know, if we lived in the opposite world where legendary wasn't all upside marker, and you know, someone had said, hey, why don't we change it so you can only have one legend in play at a time? I would say that's stupid. This, you know, why would we make something all downside? So it might partially just be, you know, where I'm starting from and what I'm used to. But, you know, currently I do like doing it.
So you find that the legend rule allows you to sort of push a creature now and again, or even a land or enchantment, as it were.
Yeah, it lets us make designs of something where we can say, if you have one of these on the battlefield, perfectly fine, everything's great. If you have two, oh boy, things are just out of control and it's very hard to balance. It lets us make cards easily that operate with that restriction.
Got it. And I realized I just used a term that we super enfranchised people, which is funny to think about, understand, and it's the term pushing it, right? Can you explain what that means in a development context, to push a card?
Yeah, so not every card is the same power level. Right. I mean, that would be pretty boring because, you know, you can imagine playing chess is where every piece is the same power level is kind of just like playing checkers. And you add a lot of strategic depth by having cards that are better or worse at certain times. And frequently what will happen is not because we were trying to make one deck stronger or one deck weaker, but what you'll end up have happening is that one deck in the metagame is just stronger than everything else. Maybe it, you know, there was a card or two that we misevaluated. Maybe there was some other external factors. And so we'll take something and say, okay, well, we're going to make it slightly stronger than we normally would just to kind of either give some power to something else or to increase a strategy that's really having problems. So, you know, if control decks are having a lot of problems, then we can always make one or two of its cards a little stronger than we normally would like to in a vacuum, but it's kind of doing the thing of kind of riding the rest of the boat with a little bit of extra, you know, ballast over here.
So apocryphally, we've heard that Siege Rhino is an example where you sort of push something in response to the meta, but then it was done late. Is that true? Was Siege Rhino kind of pushed in order to compensate for something you guys saw in the FFL?
Kind of. I mean, the thing that I've talked about before is on my article is there's this card First Response that you probably don't remember from M15. It's a 4-mana enchantment that says whenever you, I think it's at the beginning of each turn, if you took a damage last turn, make a 1/1. And it had started out cheaper, and we found that with Painlands, people were just making a lot of 1/1s. And so we ended up bumping the cost of that up a bit from, it started at 2, went to 3, then went to 4. And what we were finding was that the Abzan decks were just really far behind because they were having a hard time getting around those, having a hard time with some other stuff. And so we, you know, took Siege Rhino and made it a little stronger. It had been a 3-mana, 3/4 that drained 2. And so we swapped it in Anafenza in mana cost. Anafenza had been larger and put more counters on things, swapped the mana cost, made it into the 4/5 trample so it could get over the tokens, and made Anafenza so that, you know, she was a 3-mana 4/4. And so, yeah, obviously that happened late in the process, really changed stuff. At the time, we did not think that Abzan was, you know, far and away the best of the clans. Looking back on it, certainly... If you had said to me, hey, did you know that Savage Knuckleblade is just going to see basically no standard play, I would not have believed you, because we were playing a ton of Savage Knuckleblade. Things just were slightly different in our metagame. And to me, the big thing that happened with cons was that we needed to have at least one very strong wedge card in each clan. Otherwise, people were just not playing three colors. Like,
right.
You know, it makes sense. Like, why would you play three colors unless we're actually giving you a strong wedge card? And basically every clan got one strong wedge card, but partially because of that switch where Siege Rhino was the playable one and Anafenza was not very playable, we make the switch and they both are playable. So all of a sudden Abzan has two and everyone else has one and arguably none. If you look at Teemer, then Knuckleblade doesn't show up. All of a sudden, instead of it being larger than Siege Rhino, it's smaller than Siege Rhino, so Teemer doesn't really show up. And Jeskai has the Mantis Rider, which shows up, but the rest of it's, you know, it still only has one wedge card. Well, Abzan has two wedge cards, and I think that just that little bit of having one additional kind of powerful wedge card is a lot of what took Abzan from being, well, all these clans are about equal, to being like, yeah, okay, Abzan is definitely the strongest of the clans.
Those Abzan mirror matches were painful to watch on the Pro Tour.
Yeah,
real painful. 400 plus life each, and it was, yeah, just a never-ending game.
Now, we've all basically done some game work, and one of the things that I like to do is make sure that we have a post-mortem at the end of each project. Do you guys do a similar thing where you look at that and you do that analysis and say, okay, this just had two playable three-color cards in the wedge, and that is what made the difference?
Yeah, I mean, we do talk about a lot about that. We have different levels of postmortems. I mean, we have kind of a thing that we started doing more of now is doing postmortems, you know, earlier on and kind of talking more about the whole process of everything that's involved. And it's not just like, oh, how do we balance this stuff? It's stuff like, you know, having when you have a postmortem about cons, you know, we would be talking a lot about this block structure. Did that work? Did that not work? What were the, like, you know, looking back at cons, the thing that I find was the most damaging for making it work in the standard year was the fact that we started off with wedges and went into dragons, but that are two color. And the problem is if you start off with two color things and you move into three color things, like you can do that and make things change because three color cards are just naturally stronger than two color cards because they're harder to cast. And when you try to go the opposite way, it's difficult because we're not going to say, well, we'll just add wasteland so people who want to cast three color things don't get to cast their cards. And wasn't something that we were necessarily thinking about as we were starting on it. But, you know, in hindsight, yeah, maybe if we had said, okay, the first set are these two color clans that turn into three color dragons at the end, or something like that, that would have done been much easier for us to create a year where everything was kind of more balanced and fluid. And certainly, as the development team, we do definitely talk a lot about, okay, what happened, what's going well, what's not going well. Usually around the time of the Pro Tour, we kind of look at, or I guess it's actually a couple weeks after the Pro Tour, we look at how Standard is doing and kind of, you know, what the variety of decks are and compare that to what we predicted from a year earlier. So, you know, right now Eldritch Moon is the next set. So a couple weeks after the Pro Tour, we'll have a postmortem that basically talks about, okay, here are our predictions for Eldritch Moon. Here's what's actually showed up. But then at the same time, we'll also have a meeting that's basically looking at a future set and saying, okay, here's what we're predicting this set's going to do. And, you know, that set is almost a year out, so we're going to be wrong on stuff. But it's mostly saying, okay, just getting something on record so we can say, here's what we have a clear record of, here's what we thought was going to happen, so we can't, like, change our story later on and say, well, yeah, we knew. Yeah, we knew Abzan was going to be the best deck. That was clear. I mean, we want to be able to say, okay, here are our predictions and see how close we can get and trying to make sure that we are thinking about things correctly and making good decisions with theoretical data as opposed to just kind of every year doing this and just saying, you know, oh, whatever happened and acting as though that was the right decision, even though we know that we're not going to always make the right decision.
So did you guys predict that white and green and Bant would kind of be dominating Standard right about now?
We did not predict that exactly. We definitely knew that white was strong. The big thing that was different for us was we were expecting a lot more Atarkas, and I'm not exactly sure. I mean, we saw this going on for a while, especially when like the red-green goggles deck was big.
Yeah.
And so what we were finding was, oh boy, you know, people are ramping into Atarka a lot, and it's really just smashing all these kind of white decks and all these, you know, cheap white-green decks. And we try to do things to compensate. And obviously in this case, things that we were finding fruitful to do with the red-green decks didn't really show up. Things like certainly before Shadows, there was a lot more we were expecting. What's the name of the card? The 4GG put a one. It's a card from cons. It's like a summoning trap.
See the Unwritten?
Yeah, See the Unwritten. We were expecting a lot more See the Unwritten. And so we were playing a lot of See the Unwritten decks with Eldrazi and Atarkas. And so it was just like, boy, this has been. And we move into this, and there was a lot of very good ramp stuff. And we're like, man. Boy, this, you know, everyone just keeps playing Atarka on like turn four, so it's really hard to play an aggressive deck in this format. We make some adjustments, you know, at that point we're still playing Atarka decks a lot, so we're not super worried about what's going on with the white green decks. We think that everything's relatively balanced. You know, we end up of course missing a few cards here and there,
yeah,
and we missed some up and some down, which we're expecting, except in the just in the way things fell here. Obviously, white-green ended up with a lot of the things that we had aimed somewhere and we missed high, or they are stronger than we expected. And a lot of the other colors had cards that we were kind of expecting to show up and just haven't really found their niche. I mean, I'm hoping certainly that with Eldritch Moon, what we'll find is we certainly added things to green and white, but I think my hope is, of course, that what ends up happening is that the other decks were kind of a little too far below the line, and the amount of stuff we added to green and white doesn't do enough to kind of just do the value over replacement so much that the other decks that are getting cards that were way above their value over replacement kind of keeps things a little more balanced and gives you a lot of options. I mean, certainly we've added a lot of very powerful things, especially in blue and black, I think, in this set, that will ideally, you know, put the control decks at a point where they actually have the resources to kind of play strong card drawing spells and things like that. And Delirium decks certainly have gotten a ton of great cards. So even though it is still green, I think a green-black Delirium deck is quite different from the green-white token decks you've been seeing play. And obviously we've got all these Emerge decks, you know, so if someone's playing a green-blue Emerge deck, that might also be different enough from white-green tokens or something that even though we still see a lot of green in the format, the decks are at least very fluid and things there are changing, so it doesn't feel as though we've kind of what's going on now where it's mostly very, very heavy white things.
Adding Tameo is certainly going to do nothing to get people off of Bant until rotation, though.
Well, it's true, though. I will say that Tameo, if Tameo pushes out Collected Company in some decks, then I'll be okay enough with that, that at least people are doing different things. Certainly, it is, you know, if we were not expecting people to play both Tameo and Collected Company a ton in Bant decks, just due to the fact that they're both four drops, and Collected Company really wants to have a critical mass of creatures, but, you know, we'll see.
Well, speaking from a commander perspective, Bant Super Friends decks really needed an extra help. So, cheers. Cheers for that.
Yeah, they were at a significant disadvantage.
Yeah, not... I mean, doubling season into a free omniscience with, why not have Ancestral Recall on it just for... good measure as well.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Now,
great.
Sam, we normally start out asking this. Do you actually play much Commander?
I don't play much Commander now. I played it many years ago before I started working at Wizards. I played a bit of it. I had a group of friends that played it, though we were really spiky about it. So, like, when I tell you that the Commander I enjoyed playing the most was Shroom... and I was not doing the most degenerate things with people I was playing with. That will probably give you an idea. Like, one of my friends, he had a Mimeoplasm turn 2 commander deck. That was the goal, was just to kill everyone on turn 2. So, not necessarily taking the slow group game aspects of Commander that many people like. More of the what's the most degenerate thing you can do with given these parameters.
That's exciting. Yeah, Shroom is among our most busted commanders, according to a poll that was seeded by our patrons.
Yeah.
She's such a deceptive one. If you don't know Magic very well, and you read Shroom, you'd say, well, you know, it's right. It's 7 mana for a 5/5. You get an artifact back. What could you possibly do that's broken with that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's nothing to that.
No.
Sculpting Steel is probably totally fine with Shroom.
Yeah, no issues.
So how does the development team, this is sort of related to the discussion of the essentially the future league we were talking about, how does the development team decide which archetypes to rotate into the standard meta, right, to keep it continuously in flux?
We obviously try to say, okay, there's always going to be some kind of aggressive decks and some kind of control decks and some kind of mid-range decks. Occasionally, we'll kind of put our fingers on the scale a bit to pump something up if we're trying to highlight what the new thing is doing. I mean, certainly the Conjurer, for instance, there was a lot more mid-range, but part of the reason for that was that our goal, you know, as a development team, design is like, okay, we have this wedge world, and that's the big thing, and creative has built a world around wedges. If the standard environment is just all monocolor decks, then something's going wrong, because why are you supposed to be excited about Wedge World when we're not really making wedges good? And so when part of the thing the development team is supposed to do is say, hey, how do we make this set's themes work? And, you know, the best way to make wedges work is to make mid-range strong, because that's where you're going to see the kind of the biggest benefits for wedge cards. And when we're looking at shadows, for instance, you know, the things that we need to make work are going to be things like, well, we need to make tribal work, we need to make graveyard stuff work. You know, we're trying to make it so that the themes of the set and themes of the block are not only showing up in limited, but also showing up in standard matches. And sometimes that means taking something that people get, you know, really like, and this is their standard deck that they like the most. And then for some period of time, it's like, yeah, that's not going to be quite as good, because it's really good against the theme that we're trying to kind of push. And that's what this block is about. And when that block is not the newest block, then usually your thing will come back. I mean, everything's very cyclical. We understand, like, you know, that before Eldritch Moon, certainly, that the red decks had kind of fallen out of favor and there really wasn't enough stuff for it. We've added some stuff in Eldritch Moon to kind of help the red decks out. But, you know, that was less of a conscious thing, but more of like, yeah, over time we're going to see more and more red stuff coming up, and we'll probably end up seeing less and less really powerful white decks.
Yay.
Can't guarantee that. We've certainly been wrong before in the past.
Right.
But, you know, we obviously do look at the real world and say, okay, these cards were stronger than we were expecting. Let's make sure that we're not making a ton of powerful white cards the next year.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So you sort of back away from whatever is performing really well in order to give the other colors a chance to rotate in. The colors and strategies, sorry.
Right, and this sort of, you saw this happen a bit, actually, with current standard, where one of the problems with blue was that Jace Friend's Prodigy was so strong that we pulled back probably, you know, in hindsight, further than we should have on blue stuff. Like, we were very worried about the blue madness decks, because having the strongest card in the format being a blue madness outlet was very strong with those decks. So if all of a sudden, you know, if you make the circular logic instead of the blue counterspell we had, then you know you'd probably have seen way more blue happening over the last few months, and people would be saying, you know, it's the alternate timeline thing of, you know, you watch, you know, you ever see the show Sliders, every week they went to a new world where something very minor was different, and usually it was something really stupid, but it's like, oh, in this world, we never dropped the nuclear bomb, and so which has somehow caused a comet coming towards Earth to destroy anything, and if we only had a nuclear bomb, we could destroy it, and so they have to solve that problem. But, you know, in every one of those worlds, you know, no one ever thinks about, like, they don't spend a ton of time thinking, oh, what if, you know, or, you know, what if FDR hadn't been assassinated in 1938? Would we have gotten into World War II? Who knows? Like, that's, they don't spend a ton of time thinking about that exactly. And so, you know, you think about standard and we're saying, boy, this green white deck is really oppressive. You don't think about the world where everyone's saying, boy, this, you know, blue madness deck's really oppressive. What were we all thinking? Couldn't you make the white card stronger? You know, that's just what we have to live with. And we make these decisions and we try to get it to a point where we don't know what the strongest deck is, because if we can figure out what the strongest deck is relatively easy, then we put it out to the hive mind of Magic Standard players and they're going to solve it real quick.
Yeah, have you guys calculated, like, how many minutes after release it takes before the community has played more games than you have in your entire development process?
Oh, who knows? It you know, certainly for limited games, you know, our average set, I want to say, between design and development, probably gets somewhere around maybe 60 total limited playtests. Maybe, like, some sets are just way different. Like, I know Innistrad had something like 9 drafts during development. Like, that was it for the whole set.
Wow.
More design, but yeah. That was it. They were just like 9 drafts.
Are they full 8-person drafts, or did you not get...
Full 8-person drafts. Well, and they weren't actually 9 drafts. It was more like something probably like 5 drafts and 4 sealed decks or something. And that's just how much, you know, kind of time they had and how much of what the set needed to be worked on was the stuff for limited. And actually, that was a time when we were really short on people.
Yeah.
And so it's like, yeah, that's... If we do... a total of 9 drafts for Innistrad or whatever, then, yep, by the end of the first weekend, people in the real world have played way more of it than we ever have. And so we have to make sure that at the end of those 9 drafts, all of which, by the way, are not with the final set, because we never actually do any limited playtesting with the final set, because if we did, we would end up changing something.
Right.
So, yeah, believe it or not, none. If we ever get the opportunity to change anything, we're just going to do it. So, you know, at some point it's pencils down, and we get it to a point where, you know, we don't know what's the best thing or what's the worst thing. And, yep, it's people real quickly. They figure out stuff really quickly. Luckily, we have good processes in place. We have a lot of very smart people. And so we do a really good job of making it so that these things are very deep and so that people can enjoy their, you know, 50th draft on Magic Online and still be finding out new things. And so we've built a process and a game where that is can occur without us actually also having to do those 50 drafts with a near-finished product to actually insert that much kind of depth into it.
Yeah, that's remarkable, because the game is so well balanced and well designed overall, right? That it genuinely speaks to the quality of the team and the skill at both playing and developing, designing Magic.
Oh, I mean, for sure. Like, you know, yeah. when you look at our standard metagame where we have there are, I believe right now, 9 people on the development team. And we have other people throughout the company who also do some FFL testing with us. But, you know, that's kind of the group of people who are figuring out what all of standard's going to look like. I mean, many of the pro teams who work on Magic and try to break things with the Pro Tour have more people than
that.
Yeah. Again, the big difference is they're working with a finalized set. They don't get to, like, make the best deck and then have someone say, okay, we'll add a mana to that one. that's what happens. Like, every week in FFL, and you might see that somewhere early on it might be 10 or 15 cards per week, and later on it might only be 2 or 3, but that we just change that many cards per week. And if you can imagine, you know, even just current standard, and if we said, okay, well, Gideon's 5 mana, like, how much different would current standard be?
Right.
Like, it would be totally different. Like, you know, if we told people before the next Pro Tour we're going to, you know, ban 1 card in standard, that could change the entire metagame, and we kind of have to deal with that change on a weekly basis. So the fact that we get as close and balanced as we get to is pretty amazing to me at times, but it does really speak to the quality of our team and the quality of kind of the processes and knowledge that we have put into place and that we go forward with from every single set.
Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the sets you've worked on?
Oh, sure. So when I first started at Wizards, the first set I got put onto was Dragon's Maze, which was at that point almost done, but it was really kind of a strange experience to work on a Magic set and then, you know, make suggestions and see them all of a sudden implemented in a file and then printed, and that was pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's cool.
And besides that, you know, I've worked on a lot of dual decks. Conspiracy was the other set that right away I got put onto. It was Dave Humphreys was leading it, and then there were 3 basically interns for the other 3 people on the design team, or the development team rather, and that was kind of it. And so we'd have to pull like 1 or 2 other people in to actually get playtest done.
Well, Conspiracy is a beautiful set.
Yeah, it's really beautiful.
It was funny because, you know, I'm starting out and it's one of those things where it's clearly you just don't say no to anything. And for that one, I'm just like, well, you know, I'm like, yeah, of course we'll be on it. I'm thinking like, I don't know about this. Like, this is just not how I usually play Magic. You know, because the elevator pitch of it is like this. So it's like multiplayer drafting. And I'm like, this is going to be crazy. And then I played it once and I'm like, wow, this is really fun. I was not expecting it to be this fun. This is kind of strange. And then that was because, you know, it was a hard sell within the company because it's new things are always difficult. This is why you see in the movie industry, everything is just the mashup of 2 things, because if you say, well, we have this brand new sci-fi property that you've never seen before, I mean, that's terrifying. Like, can't we just put Cowboys in Outer Space and call it a day? Like, we know that Cowboys in Outer Space sells. And so for this, it's like, yeah, we have this multiplayer drafting product. And it's like, but it's not Commander. No, it's not Commander. You draft and you have these things that affect the draft, and everyone kind of went, well, I don't know. And everyone would play it and they go, that's really surprising. I can't believe how fun that is. And so, yeah, it certainly got its legs on the ground. And by the time everyone had kind of played it a few times, everyone's like, okay, yeah, this is really solid. Now we have to actually go to like the other parts of the company outside of R&D and explain why this is cool. And sure enough, it just got people to actually play it and sit down and do it. And everyone fell in love with it. But doing new things like that is always just very difficult.
I have not spoken to a single person who didn't love playing Conspiracy.
Yeah, that's what surprised me, was that it is so universally loved, even though it's funny because you talk to people and you say, what do you want? And they would never have given you that answer. That's not a set where people are thinking, this is the thing I'm looking for. Sean Main was the person who really thought it up, who he thought about how he had liked to play Magic before he came to work at Wizards, and he was much more casual, and he liked this kind of, you know, multiplayer aspect and his friends to do things like that. And, it was the thing that no one was necessarily asking for, but, you know, once everyone played it, they said, oh, yeah, this is definitely a thing that I want to do.
That sounds like there was a slot for a product that hadn't been filled or defined, and a supplemental product specifically. And then was there some sort of internal pitch process to figure out what that slot would be occupied with, would be filled with? Or was it that or what is the process? Like, what kind of how does a conspiracy get made?
Yeah, I think what had happened there was that it was exactly that. It was like, oh, there's kind of a, you know, we want to release another booster product this year, but it shouldn't be another standard set. So what can we do? And that was kind of, you know, Sean had an idea, and it was like, well, try it out, see what happens. And sure enough, it worked. You know, that we don't, you know, usually have the just spot where you go, oh, let's just, you know, print another booster product this year. But for whatever reason, that year, it was like, you know, I think it was a year where we didn't have like two large sets. And so it was like, well, we kind of have some room. So what could we do?
Hmm. Were there other pitches for that slot, or was it was it clear?
Yeah, that happened before I got there. Oh. So I don't know necessarily what happened with the starting process. I got there after it had kind of ended, or it was late in design. And so I don't know how the kind of pitch process for that happened.
Yeah, well, that's really neat. It's cool that a product like Conspiracy can be made even after so many years of making Magic and knowing more or less what the formula is. Of course, that, you know, that's what led to Plane Chase and Arch Enemy and several others. So the dual decks themselves, right, were experiments.
Yeah, the dual decks, I mean, they've been experiments. And obviously, it's one of the ones where I think it was the first non-booster product that we'd released annualized basically ever. You know, before we had a lot of these six-deck products, but they were always basically these learn-to-play things, or there were theme decks. And this was really the first time where it's like, what we need to have is something where if you want to, if you are a Magic player, you can buy this and play with people who are not Magic players. Or if you're someone who likes playing Magic, but you can't really necessarily keep up, or maybe you used to play Magic, instead of having to go to the store, especially at some place in Mass, like a Walmart or a Target or something, and you want to buy something that's Magic, it's like, well, I could buy this, you know, booster packs, and we could try to make decks, but this is something for that player that maybe just wants a kind of experience that is put together for them, that's pretty well balanced for them, that's going to be fun without having to make their own deck.
Sure. I work with young people, 13 to 18 year olds. A lot of them are from pretty chaotic backgrounds and stuff. And dual decks, Heroes, Monsters, Speed Cunning, and Eldrazi versus Zendikar, I've used exclusively to teach people how to play Magic who still play Magic now, and found it a really sort of focusing thing. So I'd say thank you for those three in particular. I know you worked on.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, and I sort of scaled them up. It felt, even though chronologically that's the order they came out in, the kind of skill level of playing those three decks goes up as well. So Heroes versus Monsters is fairly straightforward. Speed versus Cunning has a few more intricate things in it, and Zendikar versus Eldrazi has a load of graveyard bits and bobs, if I remember correctly. I get confused.
Blessed vs. Curse has more of the graveyard stuff, I believe.
Yes, it was Blessed vs. Curse, sorry. I know my Zendikar versus Eldrazi. I just bought for the foil Avengers. but yeah, so yeah, they're really good for teaching people if you don't have the time to build your own teaching decks.
Well, it's good because especially if they play with the same deck, they learn how that deck functions and what each of the creatures, what each of the spells does. And I've found that that limits the complexity, overall complexity. It's usually better to start with if it's a brand new person, for example, I found it's usually better to start with one of the 30 card sample decks. And now they're called, what are they? Welcome decks.
Welcome kits.
Yeah, the welcome kits. Just start with one of those and then later add a few more cards, maybe with a booster pack or two. But as an intro to, okay, now let's take at least one of the training wheels off. The dual decks are great for that. They're not by any means simple. I think they provide that multiple layers of complexity that I think Wizards wants in a product. Because you can either play it straightforward like a super sample deck, or you can, you know, over time really master it, know when and pick the perfect timing for each card. Yeah, it's good. One of the, well, the group I'm now playing with in paper mostly thinks that the Zendikar deck is weaker than the Eldrazi deck, but I think it's because the Eldrazi deck is more straightforward and the Zendikar deck requires a lot more finesse and skill to pilot. Not that these people are unskilled, it's just if you give the deck to somebody new, like I gave the Eldrazi deck to my son, he actually has a chance to win because he's driving Eldrazi.
He can punch you with a giant creature.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Often people will complain about the balance and they'll say, you know, I'll see these messages where people are saying, you guys are so dumb. This deck is so one-sided. There's just no way to beat Zendikar. Someone else will chime in and say, you're right, they're dumb, but so are you, because actually Eldrazi is the one that no one can beat. And so it's like, okay, well, as long as everyone's telling me different ones, or at least in a better spot, like, you know, the ideal spot is everyone says it's perfectly balanced. You know, it's very rarely going to actually happen. But, you know, when different groups of people are telling you that the other one is the super busted one, it's like, okay, at least there's something going on here where there's enough kind of back and forth and give and take in these that they're pretty close.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to Nissa versus Obnixilis. That should be fun.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Oh, so many questions that you can't answer.
Obnixilis will win.
Obnixilis is totally busted. All right. Now, you've done both design and development, right?
Yes.
So how would you describe the difference between the two?
Design is more about big ideas as a whole, I would say. You know, it's a lot of times when you're working on the design of a set, we know what the creative is, or we just have a really good idea of the creative is. We don't necessarily have the legendary characters or anything, but we know what the world is about. We often, late in the design process, is when you start seeing concept sketches and things start coming in, so you kind of have an idea of what things are going to look like and what you're trying to tell, and you're usually trying to kind of think outside the box and figure out how do we make this set that really is expressing these ideals. You know, when we're talking about something like Innistrad, it's a set that you're trying to express the idea of Gothic horror, and when you get to Eldritch Moon, it's a matter of, okay, well, how do we express, you know, cosmic horror in the similar way? How do we show off that the Eldrazi are here? How do we show off all these things that are changing and these Emrakul mutations, and that it's kind of the even darker version of all the things that are dark versions of other things in Innistrad? Like, how do we show that off? And then you get to development, and a lot of it there is frequently just more about gameplay and, you know, how do we create interesting decisions? How do we balance out the needs of creative and story versus the needs of not just standard, but just the gameplay as a whole? So looking at mechanics like Delirium is a mechanic that development really liked because it lets you make a lot of very interesting decisions. And, you know, a lot of people like to think of spikes as being people that just like to win, which is true. I mean, spikes do like to win at things, but what makes them happy is when they get to win by making decisions. And so Delirium's cool because you get to build your deck around the idea of how do I get to Delirium? Like, it could be a random thing where I'm just going to play this in a regular deck and maybe I'll get there. Or you get to make these decisions when you're drafting or, you know, building your deck of saying, well, I've got enough sorceries in here. I need some instants, or, you know, I don't really need to play Evolving Wilds for a mana base, but I want to put it in here so that I can get one more, you know, type closer to Delirium. What's an artifact I can find to play that I can figure out how to get in the graveyard? That way my Delirium will turn on. So a lot of development is thinking about that and just redesigning a huge portion of the set to be like, okay, here are the broad strokes that design has kind of thought up. How do we get those to actually work? Design tends to work very much in a biodome. They're saying design is more about how do we make this work? Or can we get this to work? And so they have some, you know, frequently lofty ideas and these, you know, big ideas of we want this set to be about, you know, big monsters fighting each other. Like, you know, that's what Rise of the Eldrazi is a lot about. It's these huge things crashing into each other. And then it gets to development and it's like, okay, how do we make it actually work so that happens? Like Theros, you know, I think this has been talked before, the design team kind of went this way of saying, well, we'll make the removal really weak, and that way enchantments will be good. But it gets to development, and it's like, yeah, that's never going to work for standard, because you can't just tell your tournament opponent, you know, can, you know, no counter spells, no removal, no attacking before turn four. Like, there's not that social construct that you can try to build your deck around.
But you can call a judge over, right?
Yeah, you can call a judge over and say your opponent attacked you on turn two, and it's not fair.
Yeah.
It's not usually going to work out very well, but you can try. But, you know, we have to make everything work in the wider system. And so that's where, you know, it was in the Divine process where we're kind of transitioning it. Bestow had been something that was going to be in a later set. And it was like, we if we're going to have enchantments matter, we need this in this set because, you know, we have to make it so that it's not always wrong to play your enchantments. Like, we have to figure out how do you solve for the idea that enchantments are just two for ones, and Heroic got us part of the way there. Bestow got us the other part of the way there. We had to change some of the targeting rules so that Bestow actually worked. You know, so we had to change some stuff to make it work, but we're trying to kind of solve for taking the biodome and ideas that design has come up with and transitioning it into the kind of wider Magic world as a whole, and making it so when you play the set, you're going to find a lot of the things that design found fun about the set, and it's actually going to work when you're playing with your other cards.
That's pretty neat.
How do you decide which cards from an upcoming set will be featured in a dual decks product?
So I'm trying to think, Mind Rack Demon was the one in Blessed versus Cursed. Usually what happens is, since I currently kind of manage the dual decks, is I've got a very rough sketch of what's coming out in the future, so we don't do, you know, three blue versus red dual decks in a row or something. And usually it's like, okay, well, we're going to have a Mythic Rare on the front, and let's find a Mythic Rare that we can be pretty happy with putting in the dual deck. So it's you know, do some timeline stuff. It wants to be one that we're not going to be changing at the very last second. It usually wants to be something that's showing off something exciting about the set. And because that is alternate art, that's what drives the whole scheduling process. Certainly when I started this job, I did not think about how much of my day-to-day life would be driven by, like, art schedules and packaging needs and all these things, but here we are. So, you know, it's like, okay, well, we need this card on the front. The contents inside can change. So then it's like, okay, we go with Mind Wreck Demon. It's a demon, so demons are cool. It shows off Delirium, so that's cool. So now, you know, once we've kind of chosen that, then it's all about, okay, the other cards within the deck can be things that happen later because it doesn't matter. Like, just the way the schedule works out, those can be decided later. They don't need alternate art. And then we try to figure out, okay, well, what are the cool things that we can show off in this set? And so, for instance, when I decided to make it about zombies for the
Cursed.
For Cursed, it was like, okay, well, we have this bounce spell that makes your opponent discard a card for you, zombie. That'll let you think more about, oh, that's a cool card that I could have seen in an original Innistrad that's giving you the kind of feeling that I want to see out of this. Actually, I believe the original plan had been to have clues in the bless deck to show those off. And I think that they did not end up making it in there because we did not have the token ready in time or something. I can't remember if they made it in there or not, but that you know, these are the kind of things that happen. It's like, oh, we want to show something off here. What can we show off? And certainly we want to show off humans because, again, tribal was a very important part to Innistrad. And so, therefore, we want to make sure that these little highlights are showing up in these products.
Why did you choose Geist as the front card?
Geist of St. Traft was a card that we knew we were not going to put into the Return to Innistrad. I mean, it's a popular card. I'm glad we made it the first time. One of the things we really learned from the original Innistrad was that hexproof on small creatures, specifically small creatures that attack for 6 damage on turn 4, is something that we should avoid. So it was a card that people thought about for Innistrad and were excited by, and something that I thought people would be excited to see alternate art for, and something that really would, for people that, you know, when we do these dual decks that are Return to Planes, one of the things that we're really going for is people who maybe have lapsed out of Magic. We want to give them something they can remember fondly, and I think for a lot of those people, you know, the remembering Geist of St. Traft being this very powerful card and this very popular card at the time, and seeing that in the front of the dual deck is something that is exciting and something that they're, you know, walking through a store, you know, a Walmart or a Target, and they see Geist of St. Traft in the front of a dual deck, and they see Innistrad in the name, then that's something that's going to get them excited and something that's going to, you know, incite them to buy that dual deck and maybe, you know, get back into Magic. And these are the kind of, you know, things that at least I'm thinking about when I'm putting these face cards together.
And the Geist's power level killed the Tiny Leaders format, so good on it.
Poor Tiny Leaders.
Yeah, no tears wept in England about that.
We've been talking a lot about the process. Nate, do you want to read Jason Hill's?
Patron Jason Hill asks, how do you decide when an existing trigger gets a name? For example, it seems like Landfall existed before it was called Landfall.
Well, when we're working on a set, specifically in design, they're trying to make a world about something. Zendikar was a world about lands. And so we needed a way to be like, hey, you should play lands. Usually, you could do that by just saying, make everything really expensive. Not always the way you want to go for it. And so instead it was like, well, what can we do? We want to give people a cookie for doing a thing. And the cookie we decided was whenever you play a land, do something. Yes, we've done that before, but by kind of putting a name on it and making a lot of cards have that, all of a sudden it is, you know, well worthy of having this spot in the set, and it makes it a lot of what the set's about. And so, you know, we try to limit ourselves. We kind of crept up way too far in the past with how many keywords we had, and we're trying to kind of get it back down. I mean, you know, the humorous example is the time spiral block. I'm not sure the exact number, but I think by the end of the block, we had doubled the number of keywords in existence or something. And that, you know, that was kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing. That was done as a, you know, homage to previous Magic, and for reasons that I'm sure everyone thought was a really great idea at the time. I love the block. There's a lot of things I like about it. I don't like the number of keywords that are, like, you know, a ton of cards in Future Sight each have their own keyword. It's the only card it ever appears on or ever will appear on. And that's cute, but not something we want to do. So, you know, moving forward, often it's, well, what can we find that people have done before that we can kind of put a new name on and kind of solidify it as a thing that is going to be easy to build decks around. Prowess is another example, or Menace, of things that we've done plenty of times before, but once you actually put a name on it and we can use it more, all of a sudden it becomes something that's easier to put into people's headspace and to really make a important reoccurring thing for a block or for Magic as a whole.
Is right. Lifelink the first example of that?
Boy, is Lifelink... Lifelink, probably not. Well, there was a point, I forget what year it was, or one of the early core sets, maybe like 5th edition or something, or fourth edition, we took a lot of things we'd done a lot of before, vigilance, haste, and we gave them keyword names instead of writing it out every time. And I remember actually playing then a lot of people complaining that they preferred the name celerity to haste, so they were mad that that Wizards had gone with haste. But, you know, they liked calling it Eternal Warrior and not Vigilance, for instance. Like, you know, there's some amount of that. But it was also like, well, this feels kind of kiddy thing that we're putting that's weird that you put a word and then you add the rest in parentheses and it takes up more space. But, you know, obviously in hindsight, being able to say this creature has haste as opposed to, you know, the creature that can't be affected by summoning sickness can use his tap ability in its first turn. It's much easier to just say haste, vigilance, and stuff. And I think those were some of the first ones that got it. But yeah, I mean, over the years, Lifelink, Future Sight, actually, one of the things they added was Death Touch, which it's now hard to remember that, you know, that was a future shifted card because there had never been Death Touch before. Hmm. And we added Death Touch, and it's very simple. It's much easier to say these creatures all have Death Touch as opposed to they all have some words that act like Death Touch, but usually there's some slight difference that's basically imperceivable until it comes up.
When will Megamorph become an evergreen ability?
Oh, God.
Move along, Zoresky.
Yeah.
Megamorph.
Just on that one other thing, this actually occurred with Reach. I think it was sometime in Urza's block, we changed how we templated things. And there are two spiders, one I think was in Saga and one was in Destiny, that interact differently with Falter. Due to one can block creatures with flying and one blocks as though it has flying, which are, you know, this is the kind of thing that taking a bunch of things that look very similar and putting a keyword on them helps prevent.
When you guys are choosing abilities for creatures and really costing those abilities and costing those creatures, and I should say, when you're costing a spell, period, is there any kind of a like formulaic process that you use? Like, for example, it's pretty standard to say that for most colors, two generic mana will draw you a card.
So we don't have a strict formula. A lot of it is, you know, comes down to just experience and feel. As a whole, you're right that if we add two generic mana onto a spell, then you can draw a card off of it. But often what ends up happening is, you know, how much does target creature gains haste till end of turn cost? And the answer is, well, it can't, you know, we probably don't want to charge zero for it because of color pie reasons. And it's definitely, if you go to one mana, it's definitely not there. Well, you know, we could charge two mana total, but people still aren't going to play it. So, okay, we can just charge you one mana for just that effect, because now just drawing a card plus getting a minor effect on top of it is equal to one mana. And it might be that, you know, when you get to a higher mana cost, the difference between 4 and 5 mana is different than the difference between 5 and 6 mana. You know,
right.
We kind of expect that your first few land drops and first few point, you know, kind of amount of mana are going to be easier than your next few. So if you certainly look at the power level of cards, the difference between a 2-drop and a 3-drop versus like a 6-drop and a 7-drop is massive. You know, once you get to like 7 to 8, it's like, well, you have to add a lot more than drawing a card to a spell that costs 7 if you want to make it 8. That might be 2 extra cards. So we have some general ideas about how much things should cost. They certainly do not scale up linearly through the mana system.
I was going to say, what about when you get to 13 mana? You'd never do a spell like that, would you?
You get a lot for 13 mana. Not a little bit.
Yeah.
You certainly do. Weirdly, when I worked for Games Workshop, a lot of people in the community postulated there was a sort of standardized pointing system for models. You know, a Space Marine costs this much and everything else is a variant of it. So you either add a point here, take a point off there, depending how you affected the model. That doesn't exist at Games Workshop. People just thought in their head it did. And I used to say to people for years, doesn't exist. No, you're wrong. I'm like, no, I work there. It doesn't exist. Oh, you're only saying that because you told. Fine. Right. It exists.
Like you look at Magic and it's like, for the most part, you know how much a vanilla would cost for, you know, it's like, well, clearly, like, a 4-4 costs, like, 4 mana, but sometimes it's 3 mana, you know, if you like, the if it's, like, gold, or, you know, might be, well, it's 5 mana, but there's a little upside here. It's not like we have, like, a scale, and you kind of put your 4 mana card on it, and you keep adding little abilities until it tips over, then you take the last one off or something, you know. A lot of it is just feel, and, you know, it means that some cards end up being a little stronger than others, but, you know, as a whole, that discovery process of, you know, how exactly strong a card is, I think is an important part of Magic, an important part of the whole learning experience that Magic offers to its players.
Mm.
This is part one of a two-part episode.
So what advice, with all of your super advanced knowledge, what advice do you have for people going into the pre-release weekend? Now, of course, this being a two-part episode, they'll probably hear this after the pre-release weekend.
The pre-release, yeah. Yeah, the biggest thing here is don't underestimate Emerge. They are very strong cards, but you don't necessarily have to just have the actual blue mana cost, especially in Sealed. Like, for instance, the Griff that is, you know, just a 3-4 flyer that enters the battlefield, draw a card. It is certainly best if you're playing a blue deck, but, you know, sometimes if you're playing a slower deck, another color, you can just cast it. All the Emerge cards you can just cast. Now, you may not get 10 mana for Decimator of Provinces very frequently, but make sure not to just skip over those cards, because if you're not playing those colors, because, you know, if you were just looking for kind of a big 6 drop in your deck, and you have this 7 drop that does something else, you know, that's all colorless, give it a shot. Might even be able to splash it off of a Terrarian or something, just in case.
So you emerge something on turn 4 or 5 by making a down payment creature on turn 3 or 4.
Yeah. you know, it's not without risk, but it is very... They're strong cards, and, you know, because they're a cast trigger, you don't have to worry about getting counterspelled. Well, you do have to worry about it being counterspelled, but at least you get some value out of it if they still counterspell it.
It's a lot like Morph, isn't it?
It is. It's a lot like Morph in that way. That you, I mean, you can't just play Morph cards as 3-mana 2/2s and a couple ways to splash, and every once in a while flip them up.
So if, when you emerged, you got a +1/+1 counter on your creature as well, would it be Mega Emerge?
Oh, boy. If we ever live down Megamorph, I'll be pretty happy.
Megamorph.
Say it properly. It's Megamorph.
Megamorph.